This is Jeff Blankford with the August 14th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world, as I did on my last program 2 weeks ago. Even if you're more concerned than most with the integrity of our political system, you are probably unaware of a semi-annual ritual that takes place in August of every non-election year when Congress takes leave of Washington for its summer recess. Instead of heading back to their home districts to mix with their constituents, a significant delegation of both Democrats and Republicans head to Israel, led by respective leaders of their parties, House Whip Marilyn Steny Hoyer in the case of the Democrats, and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California for the Republicans. The two groups travel separately, one after the other, taking turns as to which comes first. This year, it was the 41 Democrats who were falsely advertised to the press, Israeli press rather, as being all freshmen, except Hoyer, but a review of the list by Code Pink revealed that quite a few had been in the House for multiple terms, which meant a number of freshmen didn't go. Thank you, freshmen. On Sunday, the two delegations, including 31 veteran Republicans, merged in an effort to show Israeli voters and potential donors back in the States that despite the public criticism of Israel by four newly elected Democratic women, who have come to be known as the Squad, both houses of Congress and both parties still stand solidly behind Israel. This is the largest delegation that's ever visited Israel together. In united, strong, and unwavering support for the State of Israel, its success, its sovereignty, and its security, said Hoyer, who has made close to 20 trips to Israel. In statements to the Israeli press, both Hoyer and McCarthy acknowledged that two members of the Squad, Somalia-born Ilhan Omar from Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, whose Palestinian parents live in Ramallah in the West Bank, will be visiting Israel and occupy Palestine in a few days, with Hoyer expressing the hope that both would return to the States with a, quote, more balanced, unquote, more balanced view. Picking up the tab for the 72 House members, which represent just under 15% of the House, is the American Israel Education Foundation, a tax-exempt front for AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's registered lobby, which by law is not allowed to fund such trips. Unless you've been reading the Israeli press, you won't be aware of any of this, since the mainstream U.S. media has long had a habit of keeping the activities of AIPAC and other organizations involved in pro-Israel advocacy hidden from the eyes and ears of the American public, which might not look too kindly on such political junkets intended to benefit a foreign country. What it does think about such trips when it learns of them and their background is something I'll be exploring further when I speak with Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Washington-based Institute for Middle Eastern Policy, at about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. Before leaving for their August recess, I should note Democrats in the House let Israel know how much they love it by voting 209-16 for a resolution that characterizes the nonviolent BDS, or boycott, sanctions, and divestment campaign that targets Israel as bigoted and an effort to delegitimize Israel. The overall vote was 398-17, with five members voting present. Our representative, Jared Huffman, an unabashed defender of Israel, was one of those voting for it. AIPAC was grateful for the bipartisan support. We can only imagine what would have happened to South Africa and in South Africa if that apartheid regime had a lobby comparable to Israel's lobby. Outside the U.S., Israel and the BDS movement is coming to be viewed very differently. Last month in Vancouver, British Columbia, a judge determined that wine produced in the occupied West Bank could not be marketed as being made in Israel. And now the European Union is reportedly poised to mandate that all Israeli products made in the West Bank carry consumer warning labels identifying them as such. This has led an ultra-right-wing American Jewish organization to compare the anticipated EU decision with that made by the Nazis to boycott Jewish businesses in Germany in the 1930s. The Advocate General of the European Court of Justice recently issued a non-binding opinion arguing that EU law requires Israeli-made products to be labeled as coming from, quote, settlements and, quote, Israeli colonies, end quote. The decision is likely to trigger U.S. anti-boycott laws meant to stop Israeli-made goods from being singled out for unfair treatment on the international market. Despite the almost universal expressions of affection for Israel by America's political class, top to bottom, Israel occasionally does do things that upset official Washington. And even those you're not likely to hear on NPR, see on TV, or read the New York Times or the Washington Post. One of them, which I mentioned on a previous program, was Israel's signing of a contract last year with the Shanghai International Port Group, a Chinese company, to supervise the running of Israel's main port in Haifa, as well as the port of Ashdod, for 25 years beginning in 2021. According to Israeli officials, the Shanghai Group was the only bidder for the contract. On March 24th, Yossi Melman, longtime intelligence correspondent for Israel Haaretz, noted that, quote, U.S. President Donald Trump has declared a trade war on China and is trying to limit its economic and military expansion. One of the United States' major concerns was Chinese involvement in the Haifa port, which is a host of frequent visits by the ships of the U.S. Sixth Fleet, including aircraft carriers. That's why Chinese involvement in Israel got Washington's attention, wrote Melman. The Trump administration asked Israel to reduce its ties with China, and U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton directly requested it. Israel doesn't want to insult or humiliate China, which is sensitive in terms of its pride and would undoubtedly retaliate, says Melman. But, he pointed out, Israel can't ignore a request, which is really a demand, from its most important strategic ally. In the past, he wrote, when it came to relations involving the three nations, Israel has bowed to U.S. pressure because it had to comply. It's almost certain that past failures and negligence, especially in the harbors, can't be fixed, he writes. The contracts given to Chinese firms cannot be canceled. In case of war, the submarines will go to sea, wrote Melman, but they and the U.S. fleet could still be vulnerable to a surprise attack. The forthcoming Israeli National Security Council report is therefore likely to focus on the future and seek a solution that satisfies Washington without offending Beijing. Quote, what most concerned Melman was that, in his opinion, quote, Russia and China have in recent years enhanced their espionage efforts in Israel, particularly to obtain access to both state-owned and private sector Israeli tech companies and through them to the United States, end quote. Although the Israeli press noted the U.S. Navy was unhappy about the state of affairs, the only official public acknowledgment of U.S. objections was a non-binding, quote, sense of the Senate resolution that was quietly inserted into the National Defense Authorization Act. The resolution stated that, quote, the United States has an interest in the future forward presence of United States naval vessels at the port of Haifa in Israel, but has serious security concerns with respect to the leasing arrangements of the port of Haifa as of the date of the enactment of this act, and should urge the government of Israel to consider the security implications of foreign investment in Israel, end quote. Another significant story that went unreported by the U.S. media. Israel's increasing ties with China have predictably made some of Israel's most prominent advocates in the U.S. nervous and angry. They worry that Israel is risking its relationship with Washington in supporting the American public in order to secure investments from China, said Mark Dubowitz, the director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, an influential pro-Israel think tank, in a statement to the Times of Israel, quote, Israeli officials have to wake the hell up. This is serious, and Israel's strongest supporters are losing their patience. Well, you have heard him a number of times on NPR speaking about the threat of Iran, but you won't be hearing him interviewed on this issue, I assure you. In addition, in March, President Truman reportedly warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the security relationship between both nations could suffer if Israel does not limit ties with communist China, and that, too, was reported only in the Israeli media. Different subject. It seems likely that Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst turned whistleblower, will remain behind bars for up to another year and face nearly $500 million in fines over her ongoing refusal to testify before a grand jury about her disclosure of classified information to WikiLeaks. A federal judge in the Eastern District of Virginia a week ago Monday denied a motion filed by Manning's lawyers for a hearing to get the court to reconsider its sanctions, which include jail time not to exceed 18 months and fines that may ultimately total around $441,000. I am disappointed but not at all surprised. The government and the judge must know by now this doesn't change my positions one bit, Manning said in a statement to Gizmodo, an online magazine. Manning, 31, was taken into custody in early March after refusing to answer questions before a grand jury concerning her past association with WikiLeaks, the investigatory news organization founded by Julian Assange, who is currently in a high-security London prison awaiting possible extradition to the United States. Manning has stated she has a moral objection to testifying before the grand jury, and no amount of jail time will compel her to testify. Legally, she can be imprisoned as part of an effort by the court to coerce her to testifying. And frankly, what I find quite astonishing is the absence of any significant movement in the U.S. to protect her continued imprisonment, particularly when the issue of transgender rights has become part of the public discussion. This past week saw the passing of one of the most courageous members of Congress, because courage is what it took for former Illinois Congressman Paul Finley to speak out on behalf of the Palestinians and speak critically of Israel, and particularly the efforts of the Israeli lobby to stifle criticism of Israel at every level and punish those who dared out. And he did that back in the 80s. Finley, who I had the great pleasure of knowing, was 98. They Dare to Speak Out was, in fact, the title of Finley's best-selling book, first published in 1985, and reprinted a number of times as well in paperback. About They Dare to Speak Out, former Deputy Secretary of State George Ball wrote, quote, "I don't see how any responsible American can be unaffected by this book's eloquent and cogent argument." And Joseph C. Harsh, the widely respected columnist of the Christian Science Monitor, described it as, quote, "An important book which should be read by Americans interested in knowing how their thinking, their Congress, and even their president is manipulated by the Israel lobby," end quote. If there have been any changes since, is that the lobby is stronger, but it has also stimulated a greater opposition, among whom my guest Grant Smith, who you will hear after I get him on the phone, is one of the foremost. And I should say, Finley served his district from 1960 to 1982, being defeated by a candidate handpicked by AIPAC to oppose him, now Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.